Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, where you hear about the business of the casino entertainment industry from the people who make it happen. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB, and this week we travel to the office of David Schwartz, the director for the Center of Gaming Research at UNLV, to talk about the state of Las Vegas and cutting-edge issues in the industry today. The GGB Podcast is brought to you by iGamingPlayer.com, the leading online marketing affiliate for land-based and online casinos in North America.
You're lucky if you can find a seat. You're fortunate if you have time to eat.
The Center for Gaming Research at UNLV is one of the most comprehensive academic research organizations in the country covering the gaming industry. David Schwartz operates the center, but is also a renowned author. His Roll the Bones is a definitive history of gambling from the caveman to the present day. Other books include Suburban Xanadu, The Casino Resort on the Las Vegas Strip and Beyond, Cutting the Wire, Gaming Prohibition and the Internet, and Grandissimo, The First Emperor of Las Vegas, which focuses on Jay Sarno. Schwartz opines on the state of Las Vegas today, the cutting-edge issues facing the industry such as esports and skill games, and talks about the importance of gaming research to the future of the industry. He spoke with me at his offices at UNLV in September.
Even the music from head to toe.
Dave Schwartz, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. It's good to see you again. We haven't seen each other for about 6 months or so, so it's nice to get back together.
Great to see you, too.
So let's start with Las Vegas. You know, we went through some tough times in Vegas for 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. You know, a real downturn in the city, not only the gaming revenue, but also visitation. Visitation seems to have bounced back. What's your impression on who's coming to Vegas now?
Well, it's a different customer than was coming in 2006. Mm-hmm. They gamble a lot less,
right.
And many of them don't gamble at all. So I think the smart thing that they've done in the city is adjust to that. Instead mm-hmm. of trying to force people to say, no, you have to keep gambling, we're not going to value other customers, mm-hmm. they're valuing the customers who are doing the non-gaming spend.
Right. So are they doing that effectively in your view? I mean, sometimes, you know, when you have your player's card, it's hard to value, you know, when you go to a restaurant or how much you spend on rooms and things of that nature.
I think they're doing a pretty good job. I think they have to be aware of the temptation of reducing the value, mm-hmm. especially the perceived value. So a lot of the add-on fees, I think, are probably, they're not necessarily going to hurt the city, but they're not going to help it either.
Right.
So I think they have to be very wary of that kind of stuff mm-hmm. and focus again on what do we want to give people in Vegas, fun and value.
Okay. Now, you, value is something I think that's really important that could be missing. We just ran a piece a couple of months ago by Jeff Wang mm-hmm. on room rates in Vegas
yeah.
and how they've really destroyed all the value center properties of Riviera, the Dunes,
yeah.
You know, things of that nature, and there were things they've built to replace them are very high end. Is that a danger, do you think, to Vegas?
I think it is. The other thing, the other trend that I find dangerous is that you've seen in the past fiscal year, we saw room rates go up a lot.
Right.
And we didn't see other spending rise, and some of it fell.
Right.
So if you're just cannibalizing your food and beverage spend to get a higher room rate, you're really
right.
not giving the person value, and you're diminishing what they can do in Vegas and their money. So that I have to be aware of. You know, I wouldn't say, well, if you lower your room rates, everything else will go up, because we saw in the recession
right.
that didn't happen.
Right.
But, you know, you can't go 180 the other way, and we're going to raise room rates to $500 a night. And
right.
It's just not going to be sustainable.
Right. Well, of course, we've seen, you know, Vegas become such a great convention and meeting place with you know, the expansion now at Mandalay. Of course, we have
mm-hmm.
the Sands Expo Center and the expansion now of the Las Vegas Convention Center in the old place where the Rib used to
yeah.
be. Is that a healthy trend, do you think?
I think it really is. You know, I think you need to have people here during midweek.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more stable spenders, and you're not going to have as much gambling spend. But I think those are the kinds of customers you need to have.
Right. Okay. And are they spending enough outside of the rooms? And
oh, they're spending more than enough, I think, especially when you have people here on expense accounts.
Mm-hmm.
That's only good for the bottom line.
Right, right. That's true. And they might be spending a lot of time in the convention center itself and not at the gaming tables, but they are spending, you know, things at the restaurants and entertainment. And things
yeah. So they're networking. They're on expo floors in the day. Then they're meeting with clients at night. Have time to see some shows, too. I think that's a pretty good customer.
Okay. Well, you know, you just wrote an article last week in the Vegas 7 magazine about the North Strip and mm-hmm. how the revival seems to be starting to take off now. We just saw the Cosmopolitan sold, mm-hmm. the SLS change hands. Give us your idea of what's happening up there.
So the Fountain Blue to me is the key property, mm-hmm. you know, and this thing has a history going back almost 50 years now failed development.
Right.
So Caesars World bought this. This is going to be the Mark Antony. Mm-hmm. This was going to be their middle market hotel, which was going to basically, you know, they had Steve Wynn's idea about the GM model about 20 years before Steve Wynn, mm-hmm. and they couldn't do it because of the gas crisis and the funding dried up. So that was the early 70s. You know, then you had a bunch of ideas, Countryland USA, Starship Orion after the Thunderbird closed, so they didn't work. You know, so, you know, I was saying that having something successful there would be a real anomaly and would kind of change the whole vibe of everything.
Right, right. Of course, also on the North Strip are resorts like Circus, mm-hmm. which there's been a few rumors recently that MGM might take that down. But they also own that piece of property at the corner of Sahara and the Strip across from SLS, which they used initially as a festival grounds, and I don't think that was a success. Do you know what they're planning there?
I don't know what they're planning, but, you know, Circus has value, I think, to the company and to the city mm-hmm. as a whole.
Right.
You know, that place is never empty.
Right.
And maybe it's you don't have as high of a room rate as a Bellagio, but it's never empty, and you don't really have to invest that much in the customers or the facilities. So I think that's the kind of place you need in Las Vegas so you can appeal to a broad group of people.
And that is that kind of value place that people need, you know, that certain level people need when they come to Vegas.
Yeah, you know, it can't be all, you know, if it's creme brulee, it can't all be the stuff on top of the creme brulee, the crust that tastes really good. You got to have the cream underneath it. And it's the same thing with properties, I think. You know, every place can't be the highest, you know, highest room rate in the market. You've got to have places at the bottom to make it a broad enough funnel that you have people who come and then aspire to move up.
Right. So do you think that this value thing that the Strip had for a lot of years is being transferred into other places downtown? For example, downtown has been producing some really good numbers over the past 18 months. Do you think that is a change in the way people are viewing downtown?
I think it is. I think if you look at downtown, you see a really successful strategy
mm-hmm.
where, and they've known this for 30 years,
right.
you know, they can't have the White Tigers and that stuff. So they're going to compete on value and they're mm-hmm. going to compete on gaming conditions. And they've done a very good job of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you want to come to Las Vegas and see a show and be wowed and all that, you go to the Strip. If you want to come to Las Vegas and have a couple beers and play some blackjack or craps, you go downtown.
Right.
So they've done a very good job of that. And I think that shows how, with smart operators, you can be successful even in the shadow of this huge, you know, multi-billion dollar industry in the Strip.
Right. Well, the gambling on the Strip has really degraded in terms of player accessibility. First of all, the high rates, high minimums, and then the rules are pretty ridiculous, especially with the 6-5 blackjack and things of that nature. You can still find them downtown at a reasonable rate.
Yeah, you know, and again, it's not, maybe that kind of customer isn't valuable enough for the Strip to mm-hmm. want to invest in, but for downtown, they are valuable enough for them to want to invest in. I think that's good. You know, it's a good situation because the customers can find properties that value them
mm-hmm.
and go there, and then the higher-end customers have the run of the higher-end places.
Right. And you have some pretty innovative operators down there, people like Derek Stevens, John Johnson at the Plaza, mm-hmm. you know, Seth Short at the Downtown Grand, and, you know, not to mention Kenny Epstein at El Cortez. I mean, those guys really know their business down there and really are starting to kick it into high gear.
They are, and I think it's a great laboratory where you have a lot of ideas happening.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it all comes down to the operators being willing to take chances, but also not losing sight of who their market is. You know, they're not going to do something and build something downtown. Well, this is downtown for people who hate downtown.
Right.
Well, no, man. People really like downtown, so build something to cater to them.
Exactly. Right, right. Well, one of the innovations that started downtown, certainly in this market, was esports.
Mm-hmm.
With the esports lounge that they installed at the Downtown Grand, which has moved a couple of times since then. But tell us what esports, what kind of opportunity that has for the industry.
I think there's a lot of opportunities. I think it's not going to be a replacement for gaming, so it's
mm-hmm.
not a question of, I was going to play slot machines, but now I'm going to play in a Madden tournament.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more of an event type thing,
right.
where we will go watch people. They've been doing a very good job with this with Evo, the Evo tournament,
mm-hmm.
which has been at Mandalay Bay the past couple of years.
Right.
It's been around. You know, I went to that and I was really blown away
mm-hmm.
how you know, for 3 or 4 days, they take a ballroom and turn it into this headquarters for fighting games.
Yeah.
And people from all over the world come there to be in this. You know, to me, that's what casinos can do, because we have the infrastructure. And it's not going to, a lot of those people aren't going to gamble, but again, that doesn't matter.
Right.
You know, it's just another way to get people here.
Mm-hmm. I saw one of the first esports events at the Cosmopolitan probably 6 or 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I also was blown away by this one ballroom that was packed with these really kids.
Yeah.
They were a lot of them were under 18, you know, but here they are, and, you know, they're renting rooms, they're, you know, buying F&B, you know, and they're packing this place. So I think it's a positive trend, but, you know, when you talk about the betting on esports, you think that is something that will ever going to resolve, or is that going to be too difficult?
Even when we do, it's going to be a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. You know, sports betting, 2% of total gaming revenue.
Sure, right.
And most of that is football, baseball, basketball. So even something like boxing, which is a huge deal, betting on boxing is a huge deal, is a pretty small. I would say this would be probably an order of magnitude smaller than that.
Right.
It'll be a great amenity to have for people. Mm-hmm. Is it going to be a huge revenue producer?
Right.
Probably not. But it's a great amenity to have.
Right. Well, some people were complaining that there's you know, some of the people on the professional esports teams are, you know, well under 21. I mean, they say it starts at 14 when you're really on top of your game. But so that might make a difference. But then other people say, well, we bet on the Olympics too. We bet on you know, these figure skaters that are 14 and 15. So you know, what's to stop that? So, but still, you think it's just going to be a little just a small part of a bigger process.
I think it's small, and I honestly don't think that's where the big appeal is for the casinos. You know, if I was a casino, I would say, hey, here's some young people who really like having fun.
Right.
I want them to have a positive experience in my property. You know, so hey, even if I'm 19, I like to have fun. Now I know Mandalay Bay. Oh, it's a pretty cool place. That's where, you know, I saw Evo, and that's you know, so that's cool. That's the value now for them.
Right. No question. So, you know, Vegas is, and it's been, particularly UNLV, is really taking an interest in this. Do you think Vegas can really become the center of esports in the U.S.?
I don't know if we'll be the center, but I think we'll definitely be a hub. I know here in the Center for Gaming Research, I'm trying to broaden our collections, and I've actually got a survey out now where people who research this stuff can contribute, and we're, you know, we're actively collecting and trying to build collections that will support serious research into this, so people will have better ideas. You know, and that's something I've been researching a lot too, and it's amazing looking at the parallels between gambling and esports.
Right, no question. Well, you know, the other thing this leads into, and it really started with Daily Fantasy Sports, is sports betting.
Yeah.
You know, we've had such a tremendous change in the landscape there in the past couple of years, and now it almost seems like, you know, it's just on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if somebody had asked me 10 years ago, you know, or even 5 years ago, when sports betting would be legal, I would have said at least 10 years, but now that's only 2 years ago, and now it looks like it's on the horizon. What's your impression of that?
I think it's so popular that it'll be very hard to keep it contained.
Right.
You know, once you have the major leagues dropping their opposition, you know, I'm not saying they're going to be in favor of it.
Right.
I'm just saying they're not going to fight it tooth and nail.
Mm.
I think it becomes so much easier because
they're
really the only people who care. I mean, you have your hardcore anti-gambling people, but that's not a lobby that the politicians really listen to.
Right.
You know, as opposed to the leagues who are.
Mm.
So I think that really is key.
Right. The leagues have the money.
Yeah.
The anti-gambling people.
They don't, unfortunately.
Do you think the AGA is doing a good job in pressing this argument and framing it in a way that will make it acceptable to legislators?
I think so, because at the end of the day, you know, people really like doing this.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are already doing it.
Right.
Let them do it legally, and you can channel some of that to the public good, and I think that's the best argument for it.
I think the really good argument is the failure of the PASPA bill.
Yeah.
You know, that just didn't do what it was supposed to do. I mean, it's only restricted, you know, the legal gambling, and the illegal gambling has exploded.
Oh, yeah. And we see people are very clever in ways to get around this. So daily fantasy sports is a way to allow people that thrill of, I don't want to say betting, because
then you
get them all mad, but, you know, basically speculating the outcome using skill.
Right.
Which is what I think sports bettors do as well.
Right.
But, you know, that's, you know, I think there's such a huge appetite for that, and the states are never going to not need money, so why not satisfy both?
Sure, okay. Well, another skill, the thing you just mentioned, was skill games that they're starting to introduce onto the floor, which are, you know, pseudo video games that are built into slot machine cabinets, or sometimes not, sometimes in a different format. I'm not sure how much accepted it's been. What's your impression?
I've seen some really interesting products, like really good stuff. Mm-hmm. Again, it's difficult because if you look at why people play video games, it's different from why people play slot machines. You know, people don't do it so much for the financial outcome. A lot of it is competition, which you can turn into that. Mm-hmm. A lot of it's exploration. You know, you want to find new things, which isn't going to work so well on that kind of model. You know, also the... So I picked up three new games in a Steam sale last night, and I think I paid $5.
Right.
And I'm going to have dozens, if not hundreds of hours of enjoyment with them, with my family, for the next several months. So it's kind of hard to beat that math.
Right.
You can't really do it with that, with a slot platform.
Sure.
So you're fighting up against that. You know, on the other hand, people want something different.
Right.
And standard slot is not going to appeal to a lot of people. So I think you have to continue to try to experiment and find the thing that hits that sweet spot.
At the same time, some of the slot executives in here have a lot of that are in power now have a lot of doubts about what's going to happen. First of all, you know, it takes more than a couple of seconds to make a decision to have a decision. You know, these games typically take 30 to 45 seconds, if not more.
Yeah.
Is that going to be a hurdle?
It might be. You know, and again, you have to look at the big picture. The slot floors are shrinking anyway, you know, for a lot of reasons, and a lot of it's just technology. So you don't need as much space to do what you used to do.
Right.
So machines are getting more productive from that angle. So do you take some of that space and do something that's maybe 20 or 25 degrees off of what a core slot machine
is?
Right,
sure.
Well, it's not a terrible idea.
Right.
Again, you're looking at growing the market. And does that mean that somebody who had been playing Double Diamonds is now going to move over and play Warzone or something?
Right.
No, that's a totally different customer.
Right, right.
I think that has to be the mindset.
Right. And also there's a lot of empty space on slot floors these days.
Yeah.
You know, the so much competition, the people have spread out more, so you have more room to do these kind of things.
Yeah. You know, so would I rather have that space sit empty? You know, would I rather pay $20,000 for a machine that might get $100 a day?
Yep.
Or do something where I can get a machine that might make $50 a day, but it's definitely going to be bringing new people in?
Right.
You know, I think I'd do that.
Incremental revenue, as they
incremental say. Revenue, yeah. I mean, and that's the key, you know.
Right.
Casinos they've invested tremendously in real estate and technology, so they have to figure out how to balance that to maximize the floor.
Right. All right, I want to go back to your division here, the Center for Gaming Research, and talk about the collections. You mentioned it before, but you brought on some really interesting collections just over the past year or two. Explain what they are and how you really need help getting more of that stuff into this.
Yeah, so we've had a couple collections that we've gotten a grant from the NHPRC, which is a federal body, to process them, so now they're very accessible. So Eugene Christensen's a very well-known consultant. Gary Royer, a very well-known consultant. Mm-hmm. They had collections. Kate Spilde, who is a friend of both of ours, she donated her papers.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result of that, we now have great resources on the expansion of gambling around the U.S., the kind of financial goings on of casino companies, and also tribal gaming.
Right.
And we're actively looking to expand our collections even more.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody has done work in really any form of gaming, anything from lotteries to racing to casinos itself, you know, we would love to accept your papers. It's a very good thing to do. They're available to future generations of scholars, and your work is preserved.
Right. Yeah, no question. And Eugene Christensen certainly has done some yeoman's work right from the start. I mean, he did the estimate of how much gambling people did every year for many, many years, and he was the only one even looking into that. So,
yeah.
So, you know, that's an important piece to have here.
Yeah, now that he's donated the papers here and they've been cataloged and they're accessible, people can build on that to do the next generations. So I think that's what it comes down to.
Sure, great. Well, Dave, it's great getting back together with you again. You know, your books have really been turning points in the industry. The Roll the Bones book on the history of gambling. I go back to it all the time to refer to, what about that casino in Venice?
Yeah.
So thanks for joining us, and we'll catch up again.
Yeah, great.
Hope you you enjoyed this edition of the GGB podcast, sponsored by iGamingPlayer.com, the leading affiliate marketing partner for online and land-based casinos. If you want to hear more about the topics discussed today, visit ggbmagazine.com for all the news and trends in the casino industry. For weekly updates, subscribe to GGB News, which delivers all the news of the gaming industry to your desktop, waiting for you every Monday morning. Please join us next week for another edition of the GGB podcast, and don't forget to follow GGB on Twitter at Global Gaming Biz, on Facebook and LinkedIn at Global Gaming Business Magazine. Have a great week.